To Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack the Sun. Welcome to the 294th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 293 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com on the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's johnmack13 at gmail.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. www.johnmack13.com. Before getting into tonight's conversation, if, in fact, we can get into tonight's conversation, some announcement, first personal. My latest book, The Trump File, a short collection of poems dating back to 2009, and a short story all revealing my feeling for the present occupant of the White House, is now available at Amazon, both in print and in Kindle formats. Additionally, I am in the middle of the editing of the Hudson Valley Anthology 2019, the collection of the writing of slightly over 60 of today's writers. I am shooting for its release in mid to late October. And now some Hudson Valley news. The writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 23rd year, usually at 6:30 p.m. at the Mahopac Library on 6 in Mahopac. More than 175 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has a meeting, a morning meeting, on the third Wednesday of the month. So October's meeting will be on Wednesday, October 16th at 10 a.m. at the Hill Boulevard Diner, which is, surprisingly, on Hill Boulevard, just west of Route 6 in Jefferson Valley. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, open to both fledgling and experienced poets, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30 p.m., and the Yorktown one is on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Shrub Oak, New York, at 6 p.m. in September, the Mahopac, there's a mistake here in text. In October, the Mahopac workshop will meet on Wednesday, October 9th, while the Yorktown one will next meet on Wednesday, October 23rd. Confused by these groups and dates, even more than I have already tried to confuse you, email me at johnmack13@gmail.com for some clarification. Finally, the October open mic session of the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center will be on Friday, October 18th, at the scenic Poughkeepsie Manor train station overlooking the Hudson in Sleepy Hollow, New York. There will be the featured artists followed by an open mic session. The theme of the open mic will be Halloween horrors, but readers are not bound by that theme. A complete guide to all of the center's many offerings may be found at writercenter.org. That's WRITERS. Out of the typo. That's writercenter, WRITERSCENTER.org. WRITERSCENTER.org. Anyone wishing more information on any of these the meetings may contact me once again at johnmack13@gmail.com. My guest tonight on the show is supposed to be an old friend, documentary producer, agricultural economist, and consultant to foreign governments, Charles Chip Mann. Chip has just released DVDs and a USB collection of his multimedia history of the early days of personal computing called Power Sharing. I first met Charles, and I will keep falling into the use of his old nickname, Chip, over 30 years ago when I was the president of the Big Apple User Group, an organization of Apple II users, developers, analysts, and writers. This was in the pre-Macintosh and IBM PC days when the first spreadsheet, VisiCalc, was just drawing business professionals in the world previously occupied only by teenage gamers. Even then, Chip had a strong interest in service and sharing, and this eventually got him into the development of the power sharing system. Now, I will play an excerpt from it in a bit. In between the development of this product, Chip had been all over the world doing consulting to the Prince of Tunisia in the use of computers, and then eventually following his academic background as an agricultural economist working in Africa. Then he became a film documentary producer and eventually came back to power sharing. The problem that I keep saying, well, we have a problem, is that for some reason the phone lines into the studio seem to be down. So I'm here all by myself tonight. To get a background on power sharing, though, there are video links that you can look at. The original video that I was in is at https://vimeo.com/338051301. That's https://vimeo.com/338051301. That was the beginning of the project, and for a while he was doing video of it, and it was being offered to libraries. Then eventually, he relocated to Boston, And he started going to the Boston Computer Society, and he started doing recordings of the audio recordings. And the video explaining the series is available at https://vimeo-.com/174580349. To once again, and correctly this time, that's https://vimeo.com/174580349. And the one-page cheat sheet explaining this is at www.thepowersharingseries, all one word, thepowersharingseries.com. That's www.thepowersharingseries.com. And the flash drive of all of the audios and of the videos is available at Amazon for the price of $59.95. Now, I do have one of the, I recorded a bit of the BCS ones, Chip's interview with Jan Bricklin, who was a developer of the program that I mentioned before, VisiCalc. And this was early in the game, and this dates back to 30 years ago. So let's listen for a few minutes, and you'll get some flavor for the show.
Hello, this is Charles Mann, welcoming you to the new digital edition of the Power Sharing Series. 92 programs originally recorded and produced on audio cassettes between 1982 and 1991. With digitizing help from the Computer History Museum, where the series is archived, volunteer editor Tom Fricker and I have remastered all of these programs. And now, I invite you to return with me to September 24, 1986, for an evening with the Boston Computer Society, Power Sharing Program number 141. Welcome to the Power Sharing Series, programs bringing together people, computers, and you. Hello, I'm Charles Mann, editor and host of the Power Sharing Series, Professionals Sharing Knowledge. Sometimes unforeseen difficulties produce unanticipated benefits, such as the case with this program in our series of Evenings with the Boston Computer Society. The program for this meeting was to have been Esther Dyson, publisher of Release 1.0 and perhaps the most influential editor of newsletters in the computer industry. However, foggy weather in both New York and Boston led to first a delay in her departure from New York and later a further delay landing at Logan Airport in Boston, which ultimately forced the cancellation of her appearance at the BCS. Once it became clear that she was not going to arrive, with great aplomb, BCS President Jonathan Rutenberg and BCS board member Dan Bricklin, co-inventor of VisiCalc, put together a spontaneous discussion about the strategic choices confronting industry leader IBM. As we join the meeting, Jonathan has exhausted all the possibilities of ad-libs and announcements, hoping that Esther would appear. He moves now to the ad hoc program, which I believe you will find remarkably insightful, particularly given the fact that it was crafted, as they say in computerese, on the fly. And now, here's Jonathan.
What I'd like to do now is call up Dan Bricklin, who is the father of personal computer software, the inventor of VisiCalc, also a longtime BCS board member and real active supporter of the BCS. The also the founder of Software Arts and currently founder and president of Software Garden. And I thought actually maybe we can take the table over here. But has really been one of the people who has helped shape and bring the industry to where it is today, and I think really has some interesting insights on what are sort of some of the hot issues of the day. And I have a couple questions, and if you start to think of some questions, feel free to raise your hand, and we can throw them out to Dan. A question was asked tonight at dinner that I thought was very interesting. IBM right now is in a very precarious situation. They sort of took over the whole personal computer industry pretty much from Apple a few years ago and literally set the standard for personal computers, and in the last few months has seen their market share erode enormously and has seemed to have a sort of haphazard bunch of things that they've done to try to pull themselves back to where they were and reclaim their position in the market. First question I'd like to ask you, Dan, is let's put yourself in IBM's shoes today. You're Bill Lowe, head of the IBM Personal Computer Division. What can you do as IBM to get back, or would you try to get back to where you were before?
Well, I think that IBM is where it's been. It's a major producer of hardware, and will probably stay that way. What I think has happened, though, is the major piece of opportunity to sell hardware is going away from them. I liken this to the railroads. I think that there's a particular type of computing power typified by the IBM XT, maybe with 20 meg hard disk and 640K in memory. That size system, for many years, going back to the mini computer era, is a particular useful system for certain types of work. What's happened is that particular item, the generic XT, has become something generic. And we have a standard now, just like the Teletype 33 standard stays around for a long time. It's within a whole lot of other things. And it's a useful thing, and it will stay there for many years, and things will have to be compatible with it. It's like the railroads used to do transportation, and then we figured out that automobiles could be able to provide a certain type of transportation, and that took it away from that part of work from the railroads. I think from computing, there's a certain type of computing which fits on your desk and does certain things that IBM was able to very incredibly well take as long as that was viable, as soon as it was technically feasible, until it became a commodity, was able to milk it for all it's worth. And I think they've done a great job for that. But I think at this point, we're going to reach commoditization of that. Just like in terminals and all, IBM used to be major in terminals, and now there are a lot of other companies that have sprung up and have taken over terminals. It is no longer that viable business for money. But if I were IBM, what I can see is the peripherals and other things that you connect to your computer are a real viable business. Hewlett Packard has shown that. Apple has shown that in the IBM world. And IBM can do that because IBM, if you look back on it, IBM is better than most everybody else in our industry in mechanical type of things. A lot of the electromechanical type of things, their disk drives, their tape drives, their 1403 printers, their card readers, they did phenomenal jobs with those things, and they can bring that that type of ingenuity to the PC world that even if you buy a machine from Tandy or a transient no-name clone, they can get the high value added. Intel's been doing that in the chip world by going after the expensive chips, the chips that cost the same amount to produce, but you pay more for them because they're special. And I think that IBM can...
We'll stop there. The importance of this, and there are so many recordings. I think we have just listened to an industry pioneer thinking over 30 years ago, similar to what we might have done. If we sat in a room over 100 years ago when Thomas Edison was being interviewed by a reporter for the New York Times, in some cases, they'd be correct. In other cases, they wouldn't be correct. Now, what Dan was talking about was IBM correctly being passed by software being more important than hardware. But he missed the point then, but he had no way of looking ahead, was many of the cheaper outfits were able to come along. They did not have the problem that IBM had, being multi-layered, having the PC, as it got more powerful, competing with the mid-range computers, and the mid-ranges competing with the mainframes as they got more powerful, or the mainframes, the big computers, becoming cheaper. So there was all within IBM, there was this tremendous competition, just as it used to be within General Motors, between the Buicks and the Oldsmobiles and the Pontiacs, that were basically the same computer or the same car competing for market share. So IBM now is having some difficulty finding where its market is. They are still the leader in the large computers, but so much is being done at the desktop level. So, and this is the kind of thing that we'll be listening to, and I think it's extremely important. And there are interviews with Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who developed Apple, with people like Ben Rosen, whose venture capital brought Compaq and Lotus Development to market. In both cases, that they changed the industry. To Bill McCrone, the editor of PC Magazine, when I was writing there. So we'll try to get into all of this with Chip in 2 weeks, hopefully. And we'll also talk about his time in Africa as a consultant. His academic background was as an agricultural economist, and he was an expert in corn. He also did consulting in Tunisia, and that was how that we got involved with them. In the meantime, we'll play some music, hear a little poetry, and we'll call it an early night. Here's one of my favorite groups, Creedence Clearwater.
Take your life.
many that listen to this show know I'm the poet laureate of the town of Yorktown. And I've only been writing poetry for about 10 years. And the first poem that I ever wrote, not quite knowing what I was doing, was called Cashing a Check. I just saw this wonderful line in a column in a motorcycle magazine. The mind writes checks that the body can't cash. The vision that many from the old neighborhood have of me is short and thin, with a Pepsi in one hand and a cigarette in the other. Others will remember me as taller than thin, hitting a jumper from the corner or throwing a no-look pass to a cutter. Others will picture me at the end of the bar in the Broadstone with an open pack of Pall Malls and a half-finished beer at the bar. John Gibson's I Can't Stop Loving You on the jukebox. Pat, one more when you have a chance. Age has taken the jumper. Diabetes has taken the Pepsi. Common sense has taken the cigarette and booze. I am older and wiser and hopefully more tolerant. I am satisfied with my life, but to just be able to once more fake the man guarding me and go up with a jumper and get nothing but nets, to be able once more to cash that check. And that line that I quoted earlier was from Milestones by Robert Reza in the American Motorcyclist of March 2006. I mentioned the down at the end of the Broadstone, and I also mentioned Don Gibson, I Can't Stop Loving You, and the jukebox. One of the big songs in there that we heard on the jukebox there, and actually in the bar in Rockaway, was called The Dying Rebel by Ruthie Morrissey. And you'd expect to hear something like this in an Irish Catholic neighborhood.
The night was dark and the fight was over. The moon shone down O'Connell Street. I stood alone where brave men perished. Those men have gone, their God to meet. The first I met was a gray-haired father searching for his only son. I said, oh man, there's no use searching, for up to heaven your son has gone. The old man cried out, broken hearted, bending low, I heard him say, I knew my son was too kind-hearted. I knew my son would never yield. My only son was shot in Dublin, fighting for his country bold. He fought for Ireland and Ireland only. The harp and shamrock, green, white and gold. The last I met was a dying rebel, bending low, I heard him say, God bless my home in dear Cork City. God bless the cause for which I die. My only son was shot in Dublin, fighting for his country bold. He fought for Ireland and Ireland only. The Howe and Shamrock, green, white and gold.
In the same book that that first poem appeared in 10 years ago, I also had a poem about my favorite baseball player of all time, Ted Williams. Last week was the anniversary of Ted Williams becoming the last person to hit over 400 in a baseball season. So, Ted was the best hitter that I ever saw. John Glenn said that Williams was the best pilot he ever knew. Williams was the real John Wayne, serving in two wars and always his own man, fighting with sports writers, but always helping young players. Williams' flair for the dramatic was legendary. Home runs in the All-Star game, the homer in his last game before leaving for Korea. His homer in his last at-bat in his last game at Fenway Park was so dramatic that the call by the late Kurt Gowdy is legendary. And the piece describing it by the great John Updike is in many anthologies. He was the last player to hit 400, 406 in 1941. When he died, his son had him frozen. Why? So that he may return. As what? Teddy Ballgame, the kid, the splendid splinter, Theodore Samuel Williams, R.I.P. But is he? When I mentioned, in that poem before, I mentioned Don Gibson, I Can't Stop Loving You, on the jukebox.
I can't stop wanting you.
it's useless to say. So I'll just live my life in dreams of yesterday.
Payback. When I was in my late teens and walking down Seaman Avenue with my mother on a cold and windy day, she would stop on the street and put her hand over her mouth. I would say, "What's wrong?" And when she replied, "Doesn't the wind just take your breath away?" I'd bark, "What? Come on, will you? Let's go." Now, after 40 years with asthma, the winter makes me pause to catch my breath and at times use an inhaler. My mother's been gone for over 20 years, but when I stop, I can hear her say, "Doesn't the wind just take your breath away?" Payback. Well, when I was about her age, when she used to do that, and this poem, Senior Benefits, is aimed at that. When I was young and foolish, in New York, drinking age was 18, I often drank in bars at 16 and 17. It was never that I looked older. I certainly didn't. The bartenders just looked the other way. In fact, I was carded in New Jersey from the age of 21 when I was 26. This morning, I drove through a Dunkin' Donuts line and ordered the largest coffee they sell. The very polite young voice said that would be $2.03. I drove to the window and taken out the coffee, said, "203, right? I can speak in numbers." She said, "No, there's a special discount for you." I immediately thought that I must have been the millionth customer through or was deemed the handsomest man of the day. In sheds, he said, "It'll be $1.94. There is the senior citizen discount. You are a senior, aren't you?" If she hadn't been so nice, I would have said, "Keep your fucking 9 cents. Just give me the coffee." Instead, I nodded and gave her $2 and waited for change. Recently, there's been a terrific PBS series called on country music, and I'm really into a lot of the singers and everything there, and it's been a terrific series. The 17 Hours by Ken Burns, the great historian, and it goes back to the early days into Jimmy Rogers, not the honeycomb Jimmy Rogers, but the singing brakeman. But I never liked country music going up. Mine was the rock and roll neighborhood. But one fellow got me into it, and he had been one of my favorite singers until his death.
Keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I find it very, very to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line. As sure as night is dark and day is light, I keep you on my mind both day and night. And happiness I've known proves that it's right. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
keep me on your side. You give me cause for love that I can't hide. For you I know I'd even try to turn the tide. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
And I'll return once more to my roots. What's in a name? I was baptized John Francis. John after my father, a tough New York City cop. Francis after my uncle, a Washington lawyer, bred as a Boston Puritan. For confirmation, I took Robert Joseph. Robert after my brother, 16 years older than me, and a member of a religious order then, the best person I've ever known. Joseph because I damn well felt like it. Even at 10, I was a pain in the ass. Both my father and uncle drank scotch. My father, my uncle for a few, my father until it was gone. My father was one of the most generous men I've ever known. My brother inherited his generosity. Both my father and my uncle bullied my mother, as did I. No one outside the family would ever bully this tough Boston babe, the Charleston County. But my father died an untimely death. Hell, all deaths are untimely. My uncle jumped in and helped support us. That's what families do. They all have charity, generosity, and love hardwired into their Irish-American genes. My father died still loved by my mother. My uncle died unloved by his wife, from whom he had been estranged for over 50 years, but still lived with. That's what Boston Irish Catholic families did. My mother died in the nursing home, dazed and confused. She thought that the Hudson River outside her window was the child of her youth, and we usually did little to dissuade her of that belief. My brother died in a hospital, robbed of his brilliance by Alzheimer's, and mourned by all who ever knew him. That leaves me with some tough acts to follow. Well, without the guests tonight, I had to improvise. As a matter of fact, I had to do it.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Regrets I've had a few, but then again too few to mention. I did what I had to do, saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times
It looks like the Sonic Drew even having trouble with the music in the studio. I wrote this poem about 5 years ago, and I guess I liked it so much that the last line of the poem is the title of the poem that I've had published in some other publication. This one's called Perfection. I do many things well, if I may say so myself. I even do some things very well. I do some things not so well, ask my wife. But even for most of those things that I do well, I do not do perfectly. There is something about most efforts, even this poem, that could be done better. I know because at times I've done some things perfectly, at least one thing. I faked my defender, dribbled into the corner, turned and gone up in the air, released, and got him nothing but net. As the ball drops through and as I start back down the court, I know there is nothing I could have done better at that instance. If only I could have the same feeling about many more things. Life is more than a jump shot. And we'll go to now to Bruce.
Yeah.
energy that man had and still has. But next week, assuming they straighten this problem out, and I expect them to because they'll hear from me tomorrow morning when the technicians come back into the studio, my guest will be George Robinson. George Robinson was the football player at Holy Cross, served in the Army in Vietnam, was an underwater photographer, a principal of high schools, and assistant dean at a college, and now is a terrific historical book on all of these the statues in Central Park and the history is done in a very interesting way. And he also has the history blog that I'm very interested in. So hopefully you'll join me then, and hopefully they'll have everything fixed. A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, as is the aforementioned power sharing collection at an amazingly low $59.95. Now, in the words the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, and there haven't been that many, and we obviously didn't win tonight, put it in a book. And as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Let's go off again anyhow with the Eagles and say, take it easy. Amazon, play Take It Easy.
What do you want me to play?
Taking It Easy.
Here's Take It Easy from your library on Amazon Music.
Amazon, stop. Amazon, stop. Amazon, who won the Giant game?
Earlier today, the Giants beat the Redskins 24-3. They'll play on October 6th at 1 p.m. at home against the Vikings.
That was the bit of added information from our sports desk. I want to thank anyone who stayed with me during all this. And next week, hopefully, we'll have guests back. Good night, everybody, or to one person who's out there. Thank you again.